voice of Bon Kolak. Mine is the voice of Rick Kogan. The show's called After Hours. Welcome. It is my... it's always a thrill to have Mike Houlihan on here. Mike is a Renaissance man, to put it mildly. He's a writer of immense talent. He wrote... How long did you write a column for the Sun-Times?
3 years.
And why aren't you doing it again?
I think they read this book.
He's a writer, an actor. He has a radio show with our great mutual pal, Skinny Sheehan. He has written a number of books. He's written a number of plays. He is a rock on tour of the first order. And his new book, Nothing's on the Square, is a remarkably tough look at his involvement in the last mayoral election. Subtitle, 82 Days on the Mayoral Campaign Trail, Making History in Chicago, 2015. You write at the very beginning of this book, Mike. I didn't start this to offend anybody.
Oh, yeah.
Writing a book was never my intention when I hired on for this campaign. I just wanted to pick up a few extra bucks.
Yeah.
Knowing you and knowing your financial state, that is obviously a good reason to get involved.
Yeah.
But there had to be other reasons to get involved.
Well, sure. It'd be exciting, you know, and especially I felt there was a shot at taking Rahm Emanuel down. So that would be history, you know, being part of history. So I... I was in it for the money initially, but it became more of a...
It became a cause for you.
Yes, absolutely.
Because of, when you highlight the book, it's punctuated. It's almost in the form of a kind of diary.
Mm-hmm.
With each date, Thursday, March 19, 2015, a dozen shootings today all over the city. Friday, March 13, 1915, seven shootings today. And it's punctuated with what was happening in Chicago that in many ways didn't affect this election at all.
No. And it's still happening.
Yeah, I know. I think it's worse than ever.
I was going through some stats. Those stats actually are compliments of a site called heyjackass.com. Unbelievable, the material.
Yeah.
But I looked it up tonight. Right now in 2017, somebody gets shot in Chicago every 2 minutes and 19 seconds. And somebody gets murdered every 12 minutes and 16 seconds. That's amazing.
And it's just not...
And nobody cares.
Yeah, nobody cares. I mean, it's like an issue like homelessness. It's like, well, yes, there are homeless people, but we don't write about it and we don't cover it.
Yeah.
And Rahm has somehow unbelievably removed him. He did then, too.
Yeah.
And removed himself from the carnage going on around this city. Why wasn't that a bigger issue?
That's up to the guys running. I was just a small player, basically brought in to work the Irish ethnic vote, particularly in the 19th Ward. So, I mean, those decisions were made higher up, but I thought it was a mistake.
Well, I mean, you don't make any bones about that either in this book. Did you thought this whole campaign was mismanaged?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you think Chuy Garcia? I know you think he should have won, but do you think he could have won? And how could he have won?
Well, he would have needed a lot more money, for one thing. And I think he needed to attack. He started to attack at the end, but the information was there. If he just kept throwing it in Rahm's face, there's people dying every day, and you're the mayor. They were just, I think they got caught up in kind of a left-wing philosophy, and you know, I don't think Chicago responds that well to all the ideologues and stuff like that. It's just mano to mano.
And you detail again in the book, Nothing's on the Square. I'm going to tell you all the places Mike will be appearing with this book over the next week or so. It's easy to order, but we'll give you all that information. You think Karen Lewis, had she been well, and certainly well enough to run, could have beaten Rahm?
Absolutely. She had a much different personality than Chuy.
To my mind,
she's a confrontationalist.
No question.
That's what it needed.
And she's also incredibly quick-witted, which I think people don't really realize about Karen Lewis. Chuy didn't. He's a nice man. I've met him a number of times.
Yeah.
In many ways, I don't think he was mean enough to be a politician.
Yeah. And this, that's exactly what I think. I told him, you got to kick this guy in the balls.
Yeah.
And that's the way it should be. But,
no. And what was his, he wanted to take a higher road. Do you think he thought, you got to know him pretty well. Do you think he thought he could win?
Yeah, I think he did. He's a long time, Harold Washington guy and part of the whole left-wing philosophy. Mm-hmm. So they want to issue it up rather than just saying, hey, wait a minute, there's people dying and you're responsible and you're the rich millionaire. That's the way I would have done it, but I wasn't running the campaign.
Well, when you got involved, who called you and how did you get involved?
Well, my old pal, Mike Pickle Joyce, called me, said, how would you like to make some money on the job? I said, how much?
Yeah. Well, sure.
And then I got my old pal, Bill Crawford, involved.
Bill, who's been on the show,
too. Yeah. And he's an old Tribune. He's got a Pulitzer Prize, so usually he helps me.
And you guys have been co-conspirators on a number.
That's a good title,
on a number of other ventures, haven't you?
Yeah. A lot of capers over the years. So I brought him with me, and we went down and met Clem Balanoff and made our pitch and got hired.
And specifically to work the white Irish ethnic vote down in places like Beverly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I have you after a break. I want you to really describe the 19th Ward because you write in here, and it was so true because I have certain young friends who work that ward too. You write in the book, and again, the book is Nothing's on the Square. If you tired of campaign books and certainly don't want to read a presidential campaign book, of which there are millions of them, there have been very few books ever written about a mayoral campaign because they were all like daily. A few good ones about Harold Washington, but in here you write, the hate for Rahm in the 19th Ward was palpable on Super Bowl Sunday as one after another voter met Garcia's handshake with expletive-laced pronouncements of anybody but Ron. We're going to take a short little commercial break, and then Mike Houlihan will explain why that anger, why that intense anger is what I want to call it, and you would think that would be something that would get people to the voting booth. We'll talk. Again, the book is Nothing's on the Square. The author is Mike Houlihan. He'll be back with me after a short commercial break. Playing Bonnie Kolak all night, and we're talking to Mike Houlihan about his latest book, Nothing's on the Square, bit of the diary of his adventures, some of them very distasteful, but some of them also hysterical, as he tried to help Chuy Garcia become the mayor of the city of Chicago. He minces no words here. And he minces no words talking about the vitriol and actually kind of hatred felt from Rahm Emanuel in the 19th Ward, where you were in charge of trying to not just get out the vote, but even sort of introduce Chuy Garcia to the people. What's the 19th Ward, Mike Houlihan?
Big Irish enclave. That's where I grew up. My brother was the state representative. My dad's best friend was Tommy Fitzpatrick, the 19th Ward alderman. So I was pushed into politics probably at the age of 10, ringing doorbells. But in the 19th Ward, there'd been a daily on the fifth floor for a long, long, long time.
Yeah.
And the Irish got used to that.
Sure.
And Jane Byrne, that was a little crazy.
You live with her.
Yeah. Harold Washington was amusing. But by the time this guy showed up, he's a... I called him with a Napoleonic complex.
Yep.
Very glib, very cocky. Not the kind of guy that would walk into a 19th Ward tavern and
But also, the 19th Ward, there are a large number of public school teachers who live in that ward.
Yeah, CPS,
And their fury with him was not so much that he closed their specific schools, but that he orchestrated the closing of some 50 schools around this city with the notion that this was, oh, budgetary and we'll find reuse for this. I mean, that has proven to be
utter campaign
nonsense.
And there was there's a lot of cops and firemen there as well.
Yeah.
A lot of city workers. And we spent Super Bowl Sunday hitting about 20 bars in the 19th Ward, and it was the middle of a huge blizzard as well. And they loved Chewy. You know, of course, that was, what, the beginning of February, I think. I mean, that the fact that he showed up and came through the snow and everything, we got a great reception.
Let me ask you, you saw it up close and personal. I thought, never thought, in public appearances, in large groups, or on TV, and I do want to talk to you about these debates, because I think you think he got, as do I,
absolutely,
really screwed over.
Yeah.
What was he like? I mean, I have found him in one-on-one to be incredibly personable and like a regular neighborhood guy.
He was great company. Well, that's the way we were pitching him, as the neighborhood guy. He went to St. Rita.
I know.
Where, you know, and everybody on the South Side went to a Catholic high school, so he fit in perfectly. When that night on the Super Bowl thing, we had him put on a St. Rita Mustangs hoodie, and he loved it.
And did that must have, though, in some ways, and you detail in the book, it must have come as a surprise to a lot of people, because, you know.
Yeah, they had no idea.
Yeah.
No, they had no idea he was a neighborhood guy, and he went to St. Rita or any of that stuff. And it's funny, he, not to knock Chewy, I love him, but.
I know.
It's sometimes when he would get nervous, his accent would creep in, and I'm thinking, I can see these old guys on the South Side going, who's this Mexican guy,
you know? I know.
And the funny thing is, he'd been here since he was 10 years old.
Yep.
He had assimilated, but they don't give that stuff up easily.
Did he win the 19th?
No. No, he did not.
See, this is another one of the great leitmotifs of your book, is that politics is, frankly, insane.
Yeah,
it is insane. It's ludicrous on the face of it. And you have a man who is despised. But when the runoff happened, and that is virtually, as you say in the book, unprecedented in the history of local politics, the crowd, the campaign crowd, must have been euphoric, but they also must have been a little scared.
Sure. Because nothing's on the square. But I think a lot of it had to do with Rahm had a lot of unions behind him, and a lot of guys are voting their paychecks, and they feel like, they spent $30 million portraying Chewy as like this dumb Mexican guy who had no idea how to put the fiscal deal together. The campaign wasn't that sharp about that stuff either, that when he was asked, what are you going to do about this fiscal situation? They said, well, we're going to put a committee together, and we'll tell you that after we get elected.
It's I thought that was devastating, but not that it wasn't true, and might have worked out considerably better than it's working out now.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
About Rahm is very glib, and you know, he can just lie off the top of his head like crazy. Yeah. He's good at it. Chewy, not so much, you know, and I think that came to, you know, bite him in the butt eventually.
When you started to see those commercials that Rahm started to come out with, the wearing of the sweater.
Oh, unbelievable.
Talk about ludicrous.
Yeah.
You and I were both
Mr. Nice Guy. Yeah. That was after he was forced into a runoff.
Yeah.
Well, so he had to eat some humble pie.
He was scared.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He was scared. That was a humiliating thing for him, wasn't it?
Yeah. I liked that part of it. But it was like, I can't believe they think people are stupid enough to buy this. Well, and no, somebody did.
Basically, he won the election by, what was it, 11 percentage
points? Yes, something about like 65,000 votes.
What was it like when, let me go back a little bit. There were three, if I remember your book correctly, three debates, were there not?
Yeah.
On WTTW. One was orchestrated by or moderated by Phil Ponce, who happens to be a neighbor.
That was the final debate.
Yeah.
He lived two doors down from
me. I know.
Yeah.
I thought Chewy just got rocked. unnecessarily and unfairly in those debates, and I know you did too. You detailed them pretty thoroughly.
Oh, it was unbelievable.
Book.
His son had been arrested for a misdemeanor, and they called him a gang member. And Phil Ponce brings this up in the debate and says, and this is another Latino, mind you,
yeah,
Phil Ponce,
yeah,
going after who could have been the first Latino mayor in the city of Chicago, and he said, if you can't handle your son, how do you expect? And I mean, it was just
I thought
so
it was appalling.
Low.
I thought it was appalling.
Awful.
What did you make of it, though? It goes to the whole notion of your title, though, that nothing is on the square.
Yeah.
That there is, and you make note of a number of people in the press, in print, and on television, to whom it seems to you that this is all a game. Let it run out. You know,
exactly.
There's nothing important here. You're complimentary to John Cass, who does a lot of beating up of the mayor.
Yeah.
But others are like, well, it's just, you know, different faces. It's just another show. It's just a different kind of play.
Yeah. Both papers endorsed Rahm Emanuel. This is, in the meantime, people are getting murdered every weekend. And it's like, it's just, come on.
Yeah.
Something ain't right, you know.
Yeah. In working the 19th Ward as energetically as you did in this whole thing, were you at all at any point, Mike, and you weren't, I know you weren't running the campaign across the city, Mike Houlihan, but at any moment did you, you know, just before you falling asleep saying, you know, this actually, he might actually do it?
Oh yeah.
Really?
Oh, well, yeah, that's what kept us going,
yeah.
You know, and people were getting disillusioned, and my friend Mike Pickle Joyce toward the end, and I could see it. And yet I still thought, well, I believe in miracles, believe
yeah,
me. And
yeah.
I'm a big believer in
You're
miracles.
Irish.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I thought we could pull this out and I could wind up being, you know, the commissioner of Irish entertainment or something.
Yeah, special event.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, that's Skinny's little job. Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
I also wasn't surprised when it didn't happen on election night. It was, you know.
Where were you on election
night? We went down to the pavilion, the UIC pavilion for the whole thing, and it was before we even got, I mean, they called it at 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
yeah.
And so then we went out and had a beer at the Billy Goat by the,
on Madison.
Yeah. On Madison. But, that was a bad night.
Would you, I mean, this is not your first taste of politics.
No, no.
But I get the sense in Nothing's on the Square, which I called, you can see my little jacket quote on the back, a deep dive into the wicked and wacky world of Chicago politics with a man who knows the score, an incisive rollicking, and I do mean rollicking, there are some incredibly funny moments
Thank
in this
you.
Book, and intimate trip. It is incredibly intimate because you express yourself fully and honestly. They jumped on your friend, Pickle Joyce, too.
Oh, man. They smeared him on the front page of the Sun-Times.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. Oh. Smeared him how?
Well, Pickle's dad was the state senator.
Yeah, sure.
They put this thing together on the front page. And on election night, Pickle was up on stage with Chewy. They had that picture, and they said it was payback because Pickle was working for Chewy because his dad had lost a contract at O'Hare Airport or something. But then they went through the whole family history of, you know, every time somebody spit on the sidewalk in his family, it was in that,
yeah.
You know, and it was really a cheap shot, horrible stuff.
Would you, after this rollicking but also in many ways very distasteful adventure, dance with politics, you have more insight now. Would you like to run a campaign? I mean, I think, you know, this is...
Probably not, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Unless they offer me a really big pile of money.
A big pile of money. We'll continue on with Mike Houlihan. He's going to be here till 2:15. The new book is Nothing's on the Square. We will tell you where you can buy it. We will tell you, more importantly, where you can meet Mike, because he is a charming and delightful guy. And we will talk about the future, not only his. He'll be back on here in about a month to talk about the he has started the Irish American Film Festival, the only Irish American Film Festival in the world.
Thank
so that's
you.
Something else he does.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you first, the curse of the Billy Goat is over, and we've got finally Northside champions. But the Billy Goat lives on in the friendly taverns at Dot Chicago and in a brand new place, too, the freezer section of your local Julasco. Have you tried these?
No.
They're great. I swear to you.
The cheeseburgers?
Burgers. At any one of the 185 Julasco stores in the Chicagoland area, you'll find the world-famous Billy Goat burgers frozen and ready to go home with you. You are the chef, but try adding some cheese. That's how you'll be able to create the one and only world champion cheeseburger.
A great idea.
It was a great idea. That Cyanis family of geniuses. Geniuses. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Bonnie Golock playing in the background. We have a few more minutes with Mike Houlihan, who will be all over the place. Tuesday will be at Cork and Carry, 106. Well, I'm not going to give you guys the address.
They know where Cork and Carry is.
Cork and Carry will be at the Irish American Heritage Center on Thursday.
Right.
Then next Monday, the Beverly Arts Center. Next Tuesday, Duffy's Tavern. And I'm sure there'll be more.
Hopefully, yeah.
You can go to Abbey Feel Press, ABBEYFEALEPRESS.com, or just Google Nothing's on the Square by Mike Houlihan, and you will be able to figure out how to buy it. And you really should buy it, because it's a campaign trail book, but unlike the, you know, Boys on the Bus or the Making of a President, the famous presidential campaign books, this one is one of the few ever written about a local race, and it was a terribly important race.
A lot of people are comparing it to Hunter Thompson's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Fear and Loathing on the campaign trail,
yeah,
too.
That's it, yeah.
And that's what it is.
It's Gonzo.
It is a one-day read. There's no question about
you
it.
I'm glad you point that, because a lot of people just sit down and they don't put it down.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Oh, there's no question. You go through it. It's like Mike's diary that starts on January 16th, 2015, and concludes
April 7th.
Election Day.
Yeah.
April 7th. So it's very, very quick. And a few pictures, nice pictures of Mike and Chewy, and there's a picture of a dog in here.
That's Mark Ballard's dog, the judge.
The legendary Jim Stormy Strong, the former Tribune writer. He covered labor, he covered politics. Yeah. He's a legend
City
in this
Hall
business.
Guy. Yeah.
He writes in the book, in his foreword to the book, "Meeting Mike Houlihan is an experience not soon, if ever, forgotten." He writes also that lurking in the shadows of political campaigns is a darker side hidden from curious observers. Here, Mike Houlihan strips away the public love-in and exposes the ugly side of campaign gamesmanship. He also gets at, because Mike is a born humorist, he also gets at the fun and ludicrousness, the amusing ludicrousness that is modern campaigning in this city. At the end of the book, you write, Mike Houlihan, when they build his... I'm not going to read.
Go ahead!
All right, here he's talking about Rahm Emanuel. When they build his statue, it won't take much. I think back to the video of Rahm watching a summer concert. Robin Thicke singing Blurred Lines, A Taste of Chicago. The mayor in his shirt sleeves, knowing somebody's camera was on him as he peeled off his tie, slipped it into his back pocket and grooved to the beat and became the real Rahm, an effeminate, tiny dancer humping a chair in Grant Park. That's the image he leaves behind. And then Mike Houlihan asks a question that I want to talk about with him.
So
will Rahm run for re-election? It seems to me it's obvious he's doing that now.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think drives this character?
I mean, as I said in the book, like Macbeth, a vaulting ambition.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah. You know, and he has a, you know, if not, he has more money in his coffers than he had when he had to go up against Mr. Garcia.
Yeah.
And he will use it effectively because he can put the arm on, talk about money.
Yeah.
That's the end of the business. You should get it in campaign advertising.
Yeah.
Do you see anybody likely to challenge him? I'll throw you a name, a Southside name, if he's willing to do it, Tom Dart.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, he was supposed to run before.
He's got a very valid...
The scuttlebutt was he got a phone call from the Oval Office. That's the story I heard, but who knows? To tell him to take a seat, you know. Well,
he ain't going to get a call. I'm not sure the phones will be working in the Oval Office by the time he is.
He's not going to get one now.
Yeah.
That'd be great. I'd love to see that. I'd love to see somebody from the 19th Ward, you know. They're talking about Bridget Gaynor, too.
Sure.
Who knows?
I know Bridget.
But, you know.
You don't sound optimistic.
No, I'm not. I'm not. But I have a window. A year and a half to sell this book. That's the way I look at
it.
Because the election's not till 2019.
And which seems really unbelievable. I mean, it seems like it, you know, should be right around.
Oh, you think of all the stuff, the Laquan McDonald thing and covering up the tape and the payoff to all the stuff. If we'd have known, Chewy would have walked right in there if that stuff was revealed, but it wasn't.
It wasn't.
Yeah.
You also, one of the fascinating things in here, too, is... is his ability to co-opt people through whether it's money or some other mysterious thing. You write here for Thursday, February 12th, 2015, two shootings last night, one in Pullman and the other in Hermosa. Father Flager endorses Rahm Emanuel. Then you write, what's the deal? What kind of deal did Father Flager cut with Rahm Emanuel for his endorsement? Then you ask him later in the thing, did you make a deal with the devil, Father Flager? He does have this ability to co-opt. Otherwise...
Well, you figure Father Flager's in the ghetto, and all these kids are getting killed in the ghetto.
And he's marching once a week to stop the kids from getting killed.
And then he gets Flager to endorse him. It's like, what did he give you, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You grew up, you know politics as well as anybody. Did this... run with a campaign surprise you in any way, Mike Williams?
Well, you know, in many senses, no. I'm very jaded and cynical, and so it doesn't surprise me. There's so many Chicago commandments, like nothing's on the square, only suckers beef. That was remember Marty O'Connor?
Sure.
It was his thing, Marty O'Connor. So never make bail under a viaduct. That's another Chicago commandment. You get jaded and cynical living in Chicago, and you think, well, who knows? Maybe he will get reelected, and, you know, the city's going to hell. I can tell you that. People are leaving in droves. They're leaving the state of Illinois in droves. Look at that goofy Cook County sugar tax. It's nuts.
Yeah.
Everything's nuts.
Yeah.
I don't have an answer. But...
You know, the Sun-Times today has a blistering editorial, again, questioning this whole combining of South Shore and Jackson Park golf courses, asking, how is this going to be good for the city? How is someone who lives in the city ever going to be able to play that thing?
Yeah.
And how many trees are going to be torn down? And you're right, it is nothing, you know, the title is so appropriate, nothing's on the square, and I hope you sell a million of these.
Thank you.
It's a very nicely designed too. It echoes the flag of Chicago with Rahm kind of turning away from a young...
Ryan Norris designed that cover, he did a great job.
Yeah, it really is. Are you pleased with this? You wrote this this fast.
Well, not that fast, that was 2015, but... you know what? Well, I didn't decide to write a book until like it looked like we were going to lose.
Yeah.
I said, maybe I can make a few bucks that way. But I had to go back and kind of go through the way I felt on all this stuff.
Sure.
You know, I had a calendar, and I went back. Where'd we go that day and this day and that day? And I rewatched all the debates and stuff. And it all came back. And, of course, hindsight is 20/20. You know, looking back, you develop a better perspective on things. So, yeah, it took me about a year, I guess, year and a half, to put it together.
And you knew in writing some very tough things that you do about a number of people that these people would not, if they ever were your friends,
right.
be your friends.
Right.
And
you don't care. It's the book's the truth.
Yeah.
It's my truth. I was there. This is what happened. If you don't like it, tough. You know?
that is so well put. That's so Chicago, too. That's so Chicago. Again, all you need to do, ladies and gentlemen, is just Google Nothing's on the Square. Mike Houlihan is the author. You get it through Amazon.com and a variety of other places. He will also be at Cork and Kerry Tuesday night, the Irish American Heritage Center Thursday night, the Beverly Art Center next Monday, and Duffy's Tavern, which is in Forest Park, which has a lot of nice taverns.
Son tends bar there.
He does? Well,
yeah,
good.
Son Billy.
A deal.
Yeah.
And your radio show, the Skinny and Hooley Show, when is that on?
That's taped every Wednesday, and it's on Saturday afternoons from 3 to 4 on WCEV 1450 AM.
And when is the Irish American Film Festival?
That's September 29th, 30th, and October 1st, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We have three terrific films.
You always do. Some of the best.
Thank you.
I'm not kidding. You know this. I've written about it. I'll write about it again.
You've been very helpful.
Some of the best movies I have seen in the last couple of years have been a result of that. Did you get more entries this year than ever before?
We did. Yes, thank God.
Well, you knew that was going to start.
And the quality is so much better. And the beauty of that film festival is meeting the filmmakers.
Yeah.
And they're such interesting people, and giving them an opportunity to thrive and hopefully do other films. And one is from County Tyrone, one is from New York City, and the other one is from Ireland, Dublin. But they're three unique films that are funny, crazy, heartbreaking all at the same time, and I think everybody will dig them.
Well, get them to me, and I'll write about it and have you back on the air. Mike, congratulations.
Absolutely. Thanks, pal. God bless you.
This is a unique and essential Chicago book, Nothing's on the Square by Mike Houlihan.
Thank you.
Take a short little break, and we'll be back. Welcome back to After Hours. You just heard from Mike Houlihan about his new book, devastating portrait of what it was like to help run Chuy Garcia's campaign against Rahm Emanuel. Henry Farag has been on this show a number of times, and the reason he has been on this show a number of times is I cannot say more about his show, The Signal, A Doo-Wop Rhapsody. I would have expected it to be on Broadway by now, but you people are incredibly lucky, because it will be performed Saturday at the greatest theater in the Midwest, the Acorn Theater in Three Oaks. Henry, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine, and thanks for the kind words, Rick.
Hey, I am nothing but kind words about this show, because in so many ways, Henry, it is such a great natural progression of your... It's a reflection of your life, is it not? You were listening...
Yes, it is. In a way, it is, and it's a more reflection of city life, urban life, Gary, Indiana in particular, pockets of immigrants, pockets of different races, cultures, nationalities coming together over a shared music.
Yeah, you know, especially in these times, I'm not having you on because of the, you know, recent national events.
Right, I understand.
But my God, I mean, this show does nothing but preach racial harmony and harmonies, does it not?
Yes, it's really, as some people have said, it's harmony literally and figuratively, because, you know, we grew up, even though there was plenty, and we all know this, of discrimination and all sorts of segregation.
Sure.
In our little corner of the world, we did have different nationalities and races get together based on singing on a street corner.
Yeah.
And it brought people together in all kinds of ways from that. And that's essentially what the musical is about. And that's why the music, well, you know, music heals all kinds of things. We know that, but
no question. And it binds people together in ways in which any kind of political rhetoric does not. The show features, The Signal is the name of the show. It's a doo-wop rhapsody. The Signal signifying the signal that little Henry Farag would get on his radio when he began to listen to the radio as a kid. And the show features how you pulled this together. And many times, Henry, you've been in here with half the crew of the show to sing live.
There's a lot of different, you know, we have people that, like the great Willie Rogers from the Soulsters, right from Bronzeville in Chicago and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he's in the cast. The Spaniels, which obviously they've changed members through the years and everything, but the Spaniels are in the cast. Stormy Weather's in the cast. And we try to reflect the music that Vivian Carter put together on VJ Records that emanated out of WWCA Radio and Gary. And the Signal, as you're exactly right, came from a Crystal radio set.
Yeah.
So who would think that a Crystal radio cat whisker scratching a little piece of quartz would lead me and others onto this odyssey?
Well, you say, oh, we've got the Spaniels and we got Willie Rogers and the Soulsters, and then you go, yeah, but Stormy Weather. You still are Stormy Weather. And Stormy Weather, the way you say it, you're so self-effacing about it. Oh, yeah, there's another group called Stormy Weather. Among the most famous singing groups in the world, and you have performed all over the world. And you get such joy out of doing this show. The Acorn Theater is a great venue for you and this show, isn't it? You've had great times there, haven't you?
Yes, and it always has been. We keep coming back there. It's just a wonderful, it's just hard to describe. It's like 30-foot ceilings.
Yeah.
It's got a bar right inside in the theater. It's intimate, 300 seats, great cast and crew. And it's a great place to put on a musical. And I know that you know about the Acorn long before we have been there, but we really get a kick out of it.
Oh, I think it's the nicest theater in the Midwest. And for its size, it's the nicest theater in the Midwest, if not this whole. For a 300-seat theater, it could go up against almost any place in the country, and you can get more about it and get tickets to the show by just going to Acorn Theater. They spell it the correct way, E-R. .com for the show next Saturday. Have you gotten, I've written about the show, I've written about The Signal, you've been on the air a number of times. What's the future? Tell me you're going to Broadway one day, Henry.
Well, you know, I heard you make that comment. Obviously,
I'll make that comment anytime I mention the show.
And you know, we're going to get there. What I'm reminded of, though, is that I had never done a musical before, ever, and Willie Rogers, who's in the cast, had done a couple of musicals on Broadway, including Gospel Colonus.
Oh, wow.
So he's a vet of Broadway, and he said, you know, you're 3-4 years away, don't you? And I didn't believe him. Come on. He said, but, you know, and he's right. We keep tweaking it. It make it more seamless, work on the narrative, et cetera, et cetera. So we've had a lot of interest, and we're continuing to broaden our reach, going to places like Minneapolis, Toledo, Indianapolis, various, and we're going to be doing a lot more of that. But we do the Munster Center for Performing Arts.
Sure.
So we keep broadening our reach and broadening our audience. So we're going to get there, my man, Rick.
Yeah, I can't. That's going to be my favorite opening night of all time, Henry.
Yeah.
And one of the other great things is this is not a two-person show, ladies and gentlemen. This is a full-blown musical. And Henry Farag, the fact that all of these performers have stayed with it with continued, if not increasing, enthusiasm also says a great deal about their feelings about the show, don't you think?
Yes, because a lot of them either grew up or a lot of them are younger. I mean, this cast is also diverse in terms of male, female, and age.
Oh, yeah.
We've got people in their early 30s up to 70s, and they all either grew up or had their parents or grandparents have them steeped in this music. So their interest is extremely high and very on point, because none of this is fake.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of what you said about the beginning of the show regarding the political climate.
Yeah.
You know, I thought about this. When you're singing, especially to me, when you're singing in harmony,
mm-hmm.
you cannot lie.
Yeah.
It's just impossible to lie. You have to do your feelings. They have to come out, and they have to be real. And that's what we do.
Well put, Henry. Knock 'em Dead. It is next Saturday at the Acorn Theater, which is, if you've never been to the Acorn Theater, it's worth going to the Acorn Theater just to see the Acorn Theater. But you will be seeing a spectacular, spectacular show. I'm going to play, thanks to Lise, just a couple minutes from a lovely promotional video you have of this, Henry. Knock 'em Dead, and send me those opening night tickets to Broadway, will you?
Thank you, my man.
Anytime, pal. Anytime.
Okay.
Anytime.
All right.
Christmas 1956, I remember getting a crystal radio and trying to put the thing together. I had a hard time putting this radio together, but it would only get the strongest signal. And one night, this strong signal from WWCA radio in Gary, Indiana, came booming out with the Dells, Oh What a Night. And from then on, that's all she wrote. That was the music.
That is just a small sample of this incredibly cool show. Next Saturday, or this coming Saturday, at the Acorn Theater, go to acorntheater.com. The show is called The Signal. If you're feeling lousy about some of the things going on in the world, this will help you feel better. Coming up, the editor of a fascinating new book, an anthology called Rust Belt Chicago, that features some spectacular writing, whether the book defines Chicago these days. That is what I'll be talking with editor Martha Bain about, so please stay tuned. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you are an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn.
I lay my forehead on your shoulder.
That's the voice of Bonnie Cole. I'm Rick Hogan. Welcome back to After Hours. One of the best books come across my desk in as long as I can frankly remember is titled Rust Belt Chicago, an Anthology. It is edited by Martha Bain, who spent 2 years working for the Tribune, where we did not go out drinking together. And I'm sorry for that, just having re-met her for about 5 minutes. Martha, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is, you've had, and all you need to do, ladies and gentlemen, in this wild, great computer age is Google Martha Bain, B-A-Y-N-E, and you will come across, I hope, almost immediately, a wonderful Chris Borelli story that ran in Saturday's paper, sort of an interview with you, and it talks about all the many things you do in the crazy life of a freelancer. You were the editor-in-chief of Belt Magazine, which was and is still an online publication. How did that come to be?
That came to be the way that most jobs seem to come to me. It was extremely accidental. I actually took an online class called in how to pitch, because I think as a freelancer I've always been a really, really bad pitcher, and I thought I could be better. Pitcher meaning you write the email that you write to the editor saying, yeah, hey, I want to do this story, and this is why you should publish it and pay me money. And so I took an online class, and the woman who taught the class was this woman named Ann Trubeck, who was great, and who it later turned out that I'd gone to college with, but we kind of didn't know each other in college, and we had all of these common connections. And after the class was over, I did not actually become a better pitcher, but I put the blame completely on me. But she did. She said she was looking for somebody to help her and some editorial help with this magazine she was working with on.
Did she,
Belt Magazine.
She just,
she'd just been doing it herself right then.
She just launched it?
It had been up and running for about a year and change at that point, and was growing rapidly. And so I said, sure. And I started doing some freelance editing for her, and fairly soon she was like, hey, do you want to just do this?
Oh, and nice.
I said, sure.
Don't I have to write you a pitch letter? Sure, I'll just do this. The philosophy of the magazine was and is?
Belt Magazine is based in Cleveland. And I am based here in Chicago, but it is to provide long-form narrative journalism and essays.
And poetry.
And well, it's not on the magazine, but yes.
Yeah.
For the by and for the Rust Belt, you know, defined as, you want me to define the Rust Belt?
I do.
People don't, because that's one of the interesting things that I've seen over the two or more years that I've been doing this.
Don't you think, 10 years ago, had you said Rust Belt, I think many people would have immediately known. And I think the definition's gotten a little more complicated.
It's fallen from, well, until recently, until everything changed on November 9th.
Yeah.
It had really kind of fallen from favor, and I think a lot of people think of it as pejorative.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people in the Rust Belt itself, which is more of a term of economic association than it is necessarily geographic. Although it's both, it's like the band of industrial cities around the Great Lakes: Detroit, Cleveland, Youngstown, Buffalo, Milwaukee,
Pittsburgh.
Akron, Flint.
Places. And now Chicago.
Well, and we can get to that.
Yeah,
but
no kidding.
Chicago, arguably. But you could also argue that, like, Baltimore is part of the Rust Belt.
Sure.
Or Duluth.
Sure.
Because they share this kind of industrial base that's dropped out from underneath them, and they're left trying to figure out what to do.
There have been so far 9.
That sounds right.
9 anthologies, Cincinnati, Detroit, Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. Buffalo, Cleveland, taking on Chicago when you and your colleague decided to take on Chicago. That's a daunting one, I think.
It's very daunting.
Why?
Because and I talked about a little bit about this in the introduction.
Yeah, it's a great introduction.
Well, thank you.
If you go to a bookstore, and there still are bookstores, and you read the introduction and don't buy the book, you're an absolute idiot. Something is wrong with you. The introduction is fantastic.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So the mission of Belt Publishing, which is, as I should clarify,
sure.
is a both an online magazine and a small press. So we publish books and we also publish this magazine online. Is to cover these sort of undercovered, underheard, overlooked cities and towns
sure.
in the Midwest. Chicago is obviously not one of those places.
Yes.
Chicago is huge. It is I'm actually leery of calling it economically robust at this point, but we'll skip that for a second.
Even before we go to a break, what fascinates me about Chicago, and you certainly do more than allude to it in here, is you could take someone from Mars, if people lived on Mars, and plunk them in certain places in Chicago, and they would think this is the most successful, fantastic, mm-hmm. beautiful, mm-hmm. thriving mm-hmm. city in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You could also take that same person and within the space of about a half hour, mm-hmm. plunk them in some place like West Pullman,
mm-hmm.
and convince them that they were traveling back in time to rural Mississippi in the 1960s. That's what I find so fascinating.
Chicago
about.
Is a city of contrasts.
No kidding.
And so it is both the question was, is it part of the Rust Belt?
Like, yeah.
It's geographically of the Rust Belt. It definitely shares all these things in common with it because it's sort of the hub of the Midwest. But it's also got all these other things going for it that a place like, say, Youngstown does not have going for it right now. So trying to answer that question is the mission of this book.
Yeah.
And also, and the other thing that separates this book from our other books is Chicago's been written about a lot, obviously. There's a huge legacy of literature, poetry, plays. I mean, just there's a great
TV shows.
Chicago is not underrepresented in the literary canon. So kind of trying to figure out how to get at that was another editorial challenge.
But I also think, and what the reason I love this book, I do not love every single piece in here.
That's okay.
But in some, it is one of the finest books I've ever read. It is hopeful. It is even enlightening to me, who has read a.
Probably a
whole lot about the city of Chicago. There are a lot of new voices in here, and that's the encouraging thing.
That was intentional.
Of course. And we'll talk about some of those new voices. Martha Bain will be here till 11:15 talking about Rust Belt Chicago, an anthology. What's a good website? Just Google this. You go online. Amazon has it. Everybody else has it.
Well, I would say you can buy it from beltmag.com, which is our online store.
Go to beltmag.
BELTMAG.com.
Good.
Your online retailer.
Yeah.
Choice, but
no,
we prefer you to buy it from us.
Beltmag.com. It has a glorious cover by the one and only, one of the world's great artists and an actor.
Great guy.
And an actor of... Some talent, but a great and dear friend, Tony Fitzpatrick. It's a remarkable thing. We'll talk to Martha Bain about how she got him to do that and how she got some of these other great, great voices, some of whom I don't know and was very, very impressed by. We'll take a short break and be right back. I'm talking with Martha Bain, the editor of Rust Belt Chicago, an anthology, and she has a spectacular introduction to this gathering of poems and essays and stories and tours. My old pal, Kelly McNeese, I can't remember, she has like three names and I could never get them all right. It was so funny.
Kelly O'Connor McNeese.
That's right. She writes about, she lives up north and writes about Devon Avenue, which is one of the great melting pot streets, constantly changing as new people come in to be melted and not really melted. How did you find, okay, you get the idea, you debate a little, I would think, saying, can we really tackle Chicago? Should we do this?
Yeah, I've been pushing to do a Chicago book for a little while, and when we finally had space in the schedule, publishing schedule, I was like, let's do it. And I mean, it didn't take a lot of arm twisting, but I just started running with it. And I put out a call for submissions to kind of as broad a network as I could come up with.
So some people who had written for Rust Belt, the magazine.
Yeah, some people. There's two pieces in the book that have been previously published on Belt magazine. But the rest of them just, you know, I don't feel as hooked into like the literary community here as I maybe could be, but I have friends who are really hooked in. So I sent the submission to them, and I made the call for submissions to them, and I said, send this to your people and send these to, you know, writers that you think are promising, who you think might have something to say in this book. And just kind of like, and they told a friend and they told a friend and said,
well, Naomi Hoffman, for instance,
Naomi
used
Hoffman,
to run
yeah.
Curbside Splendor for them. And
she moved to New York.
And they would, how would they, what was your pitch? How would you like to write about, because many of them may not have known the magazine, for
instance. No. The pitch was, how is Chicago part of the Rust Belt? The pitch was, I'm looking for stories that tell untold stories about Chicago, that speak to the divisions and contrasts and like the non dominant narratives that are at play in Chicago. And I said I was looking for essays, personal essays, journalism, fiction, poetry. Early on, I decided not to do visual art. For a minute, I thought I was going to build visual art, but it's just too expensive.
That's a wide net already.
Yeah, sorry, it's a pretty wide net. This is the only book we've ever published that has fiction in it.
Is that right?
Yeah, there's three short stories in here that are, and that's unusual for our anthologies.
I'm going to, before we talk about philosophically about what you think this book represents and what this book says. Mm-hmm. Where Zero is State Street.
I thought, so did I.
Who is this woman? Claire Teague.
Claire Teague? She's somebody who had written for Belt in the past.
Yeah.
So I knew her as a freelancer, and she sent this in over the transom. I mean, she responded to my call for submissions and sent it in, and I thought it was great, and that was it. I'm blanking on her biographical information, which
Wait,
is embarrassing.
No, don't be silly. Don't be silly. The piece, she doesn't need biographical information if she can write like
this. It's basically, you know, it's in some ways it's an ode to the grid.
Yeah.
But it's an ode to Chicago.
It really is a lovely piece about Chicago. And it's a great lead, too, as mm-hmm. we used to say in the newspaper business, mm-hmm. when there was a newspaper business. The only way I can explain is by map.
Mm-hmm.
And it really takes the measure of Chicago. Bill Savage, mm-hmm. who is a notable Chicago writer and teacher, he's doing a course very soon at the Newberry Library about Richard J. Daley and mm-hmm. Mike Royko, mm-hmm. a seminar mm-hmm. over 6 weeks. Bill's piece wound up, it's like sort of a North Sider goes to the South Side and what he
falls in love with a South Sider and winds up being in a commuter relationship for yeah. many, many, many years at this point.
Yeah.
And he bikes from Rogers Park to Evergreen Park on a regular basis. And so the piece is about that journey and about kind of coming to love the South Side. And before anybody complains, he acknowledges in the piece that Evergreen Park is not actually in Chicago.
Yeah, he does. You know, he does very quickly early on in the piece. Did you have to reject anything?
I did,
Martha?
And that's awful.
Yeah,
I mean,
that
must have
been very hard. And how many pieces are in the book?
That's the job. 52. There's 52 contributors, but there's a couple. Kevin Koval
has three or four
poems. There's another poet who has a couple poems. Raymond Barry has a couple poems.
Right.
It's 52 contributors.
How many do you have to reject?
I think I got about somewhere between 150 and 200 submissions over the transom.
Oh, my.
And so that was rough.
So in some ways, you were thinking then of, oh, this is going to be a book of X amount of pages. We're going to do maybe 50-some
Yeah. When I said, when I turned in the manuscript, they were like, this is really long.
Was it sort of like a puzzle then for you mm-hmm. to, you would have one piece, for instance, mm-hmm. like the North Side or South Side, say, this is exactly what I want. Then you would get another piece and say, so your kind of editing definition of, as an editor, your definition of the city was in flux, right?
Yeah, I mean, the pieces, I got all the submissions and I read through them and sorted them into, you know, yes, no, maybe piles. And then looking at the ones that really spoke to me, I saw these themes emerge, the themes that became the subject headers for the break up the book.
Yeah.
So then I started looking at the other pieces, like the maybes. I was like, okay, well, which ones of these kind of fit into these thematic areas?
That's a brilliant way to do this, yeah.
And then once that was done, then I kind of went out and strategically solicited some work to fill in some gaps.
Wow.
So
I'm going to read some of those titles to you. City of Movement, The Built City, The Divided City, where Bill Savage's North Side or South Side or Bi-Sider piece is. Sports Break, which really does contain a couple of fabulous... each section contains fabulous pieces.
Can I just interject for a second to say that I'm not a big sports person? And
you can tell because there are only five little sections.
Those sports pieces were in there because they're so good.
They really
are. And good sports writing is an amazing thing to me because I don't really care.
Well,
so if they can make me care, then it's really...
Well, that's something years ago. I'll never forget when I fell in love with The New Yorker. I was probably 15, 16, football player, baseball player, and mm-hmm. read a piece in The New Yorker about squash, which I did not understand on
understand
any
squash.
Level, and I thought it was one of the most compelling pieces I've ever read in my life. So we share that kind of philosophical bent. Then there's The Conflicted City, The Living City, and City of Migrants. You write, in your fantastic introduction, by October, I'd whittled down the candidates to a manageable 40 or so stories, poems, and essays, and then Donald Trump was elected president.
Yeah.
How did that change the nature of this project?
It didn't. I don't want to overemphasize the impact that the election had on the book. It definitely had an impact on me, you know, and kind of, I think, like many, many, many people, kind of assessing what I was doing with my life and my work and
sure.
the moment of crisis, national emergency. And trying to figure out, like, well, I'm in the middle of this project. Like, how can I kind of hone this project a little bit more to maybe speak to some of the themes that are suddenly front and center in the national conversation?
Yeah.
Because as we all know, on the night that Trump was elected, all of a sudden everybody was talking about the Rust Belt.
Yep.
And I literally sat there looking at the television going,
yes, that's the title of my book.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wait a minute, that's the title of my book.
Yeah.
Can I sue you?
So trying to figure out how Chicago fit into, I think I talked to Chris about this the other day when he was talking to me. What does it mean to have this big city in the middle of the Midwest, this big blue, like historically blue Democratic stronghold, et cetera, yep. et cetera, hometown of Barack Obama, hometown of Hillary Clinton, be the anchor of the region that ostensibly elected Donald Trump?
Yeah.
Like, what does that say? How can we interrogate that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, you don't beat it to death in
no.
here, but I think I sense if you read the there are not pieces in this book, ladies and gentlemen, about Donald Trump. Let me put it that way. I'm going to keep Martha for a while longer just because there's so many things in here. Go to, what's the website?
Beltmag.com
to buy it directly from them. Any one piece in here is worth the cover price. I am telling you this. I'm serious about that.
Thank you.
In the same way that if any one of these were in a magazine, I'd say buy the magazine. I'm not kidding you. You've done a remarkable
job.
Lucky
to have an embarrassment of talent.
This one, you know, Hard Hat Lunch Pail, The Myth of Toughness in Chicago Sports. You may not be a big sports fan, but this David Isaacson has wrote a piece that will live, I think, forever.
It's a great piece.
Welcome back. I have some more time with Martha Bain, the editor of Rust Belt Chicago, an anthology, 52-some pieces, fiction, essays, journalism, poetry, and her remarkable introduction. I said it before, if you go to a bookstore and you read this introduction and you don't buy the book, something is really, really wrong with you. One of the pieces that I thought was just a delight and a great surprise, and every piece is surprising in one way or another, was Jake Austin, terribly, terribly, terribly talented mm-hmm. writer, about writing about Funtown, Chicago's last amusement park. That must have even surprised you. You're not from Chicago.
I knew nothing about Funtown. And Funtown, that Jake story is actually a very early piece that we published on Belt. That's one of the two pieces in the book that originally came from the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
It was this whole corner of Chicago history that I had no idea about. It's a great piece. And it's interesting. It's a piece that still gets traffic.
Oh, no.
It's had like this long tail
yeah.
of life.
Well, as one who has written about, I like Jake a lot. He's a great guy.
He's a great guy. He DJ'd my book release.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, because I write about Riverview all the time. We share this kind of affection for faded, bygone amusement parks.
Mm-hmm.
What does this book, what do you expect, if you can expect anything, Martha Bain, for someone who sits down and if they're of a want to try to devour this entire book in one sitting, what do you hope they, when they shake their head and come out of it, what do you hope they feel?
Oh, gosh. like they haven't wasted $20.
That's true.
That
they haven't wasted a couple hours.
A couple hours of their life. I mean, that's the great thing about an anthology is that you can dip in and out of
exactly.
it. And it's not intended necessarily to be read cover to cover.
I don't think it is intended.
But I do think the book has an arc. I think that intentionally, you know, the pieces, I spent a long time rearranging pieces. And I think I agree with you that I think it's hopeful. I think I also said when we were off the air, I feel like it's unfinished. I feel like it is a work in progress, just the way a city is a work in progress, constantly changing, constantly incorporating new voices. There's so many pieces that I wish I could have included. I think that I hope that they will feel both sated and also hungry for more.
I think you're right. I think that absolutely will be how they feel. And one of the great things for you, Martha, is to, I don't want to say you're discovering new voices. You were giving a platform to some really powerful new voices in this town, and that has got to be...
It's very gratifying.
Yeah, make you very happy.
Yeah, it's that's the point. I mean, that's
the other thing you think to yourself, well, I just hope, you know, that running is a very, very precarious profession, and you just hope, and maybe you can, through Belt Magazine and other ways, kind of nurture. There aren't the places out there that nurture young writers in the way they might have 50 years ago.
Well, it's interesting right now because there's so many more. In some ways, there are so many more opportunities for people to get published.
No question.
Because of the internet, et cetera, et cetera. But it also is very atomized. And so I think, and people, you know, in politics, in art, and everything, everyone's in their little silo. And I think that an anthology like this, which really does try to bring together some disparate voices, disparate writers, disparate talents, can help to pull people together.
I agree. I so agree. Soup and Bread is a something
segue.
Else. It's my segue. You started as someone who has been performing I at the Hideout for the last few months, once a month,
all right,
with Michael Miles. Doing some kind of
right.
bizarre, doing what the Hideout does
that.
Best. They do experiments,
yes.
experimental
grand experiments.
Entertainment. Tell people what, remind people what Soup and Bread is. This is your concoction, is it not?
Yes. So Soup and Bread is a community meal project and hunger relief fundraiser that I started doing in 2009 at the Hideout, where I was a bartender for many years. Because that's what happens when you leave your full-time journalism job, is you get a job as a bartender. And so the people at the Hideout was kind enough to give me a job, even though my only bartending experience was in college. I hadn't.
Well, but the great thing about the Hideout, it's not, you know, people aren't coming in asking for Mai Tais.
No, thankfully.
And exotic drinks and the craft cocktails.
No. But I was working on Wednesday afternoons was my regular shift from like 4 to 9 on Wednesday afternoons, which is not necessarily a high traffic time.
Correct.
Especially at a bar like the Hideout, which is not downtown. It's not like a happy hour bar.
There's not a lot of street traffic.
Not a lot of
there.
Foot traffic. And so I was like, well, what can we do? Like, I've got this bar. We've got this empty bar. Like, let's do something good with it. And so Soup and Bread was born out of that instinct. And what it is basically a potluck where I invite cooks, professional cooks, caterers, amateurs, anybody who's interested, really, to contribute a pot of soup. Every week, we get a couple of different people every week. It started out small, and now we're up to like six or eight people every week. We get bread donated from Publican Quality Bread from Paul Kahan, who's been incredibly generous to us
Famous
over the
chef,
years.
And
it's just a free community meal. It runs in the wintertime from January through the end of March. It's a pay what you can donation, and we partner with different local food pantries. So every week, the money we raise in donations goes to a different local food pantry or hunger relief organization.
And this notion has spread to other cities.
Yeah, it had traction. It's definitely something that I feel I've always described as like an open source idea. I do not feel, you know, the idea of giving away free soup is something that dates back to the Middle Ages.
The first soup.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not like soup's been around for a while, but it has spawned other projects. People who've come. Have some connection to the Hideout who lived here and then moved somewhere else. We have somebody who used to live here, moved back to Traverse City, Michigan. She started a Soup and Bread there. We have a musician in Oslo, Norway, who has through a connection to the Hideout that's too complicated to get into, has started doing monthly Soup and Bread dinners in Oslo, and they've been really successful. And
pretty
I'm
gratifying
dying
too,
to
it?
Go to one.
That's pretty gratifying,
yeah.
isn't it?
It's great. Every time he does one, he like Facebook messages me and says, "We raised this much money." So.
What about your own writing? I cannot tell you, and I'm not being hyperbolic here, I cannot tell you how taken I was with your it's an introduction,
yeah.
okay? But the writing and the thinking that comes out of that piece is really something. What kind of writing are you,
you
doing or hope to do?
My writing is all over the place right now. That's a really hard question. My background is in journalism,
yeah.
And I enjoy writing, like enjoy features writing, a lot. But I've also done a fair amount of sort of essays and worked as an essays editor for a little while. I have a piece coming out in the Baffler in about a month, I think, that I'm looking, that kind of fits in with this. That's
And Jake, who's the editor of the Baffler?
Chris Lehman now is the editor of the Baffler. Anyway, it's about the theme. It's in the print issue of the next Baffler, and it's a piece. The theme of the issue is utopias. And so the piece that I wrote is about Rust Belt utopias. And it talks about the history of New Harmony, Indiana, and about kind of modern day utopian thinking in the Rust Belt, and tries to make these connections between them. So I'm very I'm excited for that to come out. See it in print.
That.
Someone just recently sent me a picture of the art that was going with it, and it's really pretty. So it's always exciting to be in print, in actual print.
Yeah, well, that's what journalists do, and it gets getting harder and harder and harder.
Now, I'm trying to write a play.
Are you?
I'm going to plug my play for a second.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm doing a in October. I'm staging a haunted house with my friend Andrea Jablonski, who's a visual artist, and we're doing a haunted house. It's being produced by Theater Ublek, which is the theater company that I work with, and with whom I also just did another huge project. It's a haunted house about housing and other real life fears, and it's going up in October on the west side of Chicago. It's called A Memory Palace of Fear, and I'm in the thick of trying to revise the script right now. So
wow,
I've never really
fabulous.
Written a play before.
Yeah. So. You're finding it challenging and enjoyable?
It's fun.
Martha, it's great to get to know you, and whether I missed you at
we passed in the night.
Yes, and there were a lot more people in this building in those
days. Yes, there were a lot more people.
There were a lot more floors that the Tribune worked on. I cannot tell you what an accomplishment this is. Rust Belt Chicago. Go to beltmag.org.
Com.
Beltmag.com. To buy it directly from the publisher. It's got Tony Fitzpatrick on the cover, and it has riches galore inside. I defy you. If you call me or email me, rkogan@chicagotribune.com, and say, yeah, I bought that book, and I didn't like any of the stories, I'll pay you back. I'll pay you back. If you can make me believe you, I'll go, really? Well, what do you do? Oh, you didn't like that story about sports? What's the matter with you? If you can convince me that you did not like one thing in this book and you want your $20 back, I'll give it to you. It's a money back guarantee. I haven't done that on the show in years.
I'm very curious to see if anybody takes you up on it.
No one's going to be able to convince me. Martha, continued success. I hope there's another one of these because I'm nothing against Cleveland, but this is Chicago, and
I'm cooking up some plans for another one. They're on the very back burner right now. But
good. Thank you. Continued success. Enjoy the eclipse whenever that's supposed to happen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. You're going to be on Justin Kaufman's show later this week?
Yes, I will be on Justin's show on Thursday. And I will be I'm going to be part of this event at Women and Children First on Wednesday night with Alexander Heyman, Nate Marshall, and Ricardo Gamboa.
Oh, say hi to all of them.
It's part of this series called The Conversation, and we're going to be talking about Chicago's arts community and how is it segregated and how is it united.
Those guys would know, Nate especially.
So it's going to be good.
We'll take a little break, and we'll come back with film critic Zita Moore talking about some movie I've never heard of. Thank you for listening to the show. We end it with a review from the new... Well, she's the old, but now new film critic. She used to be a theater critic for my show, Zita Moore, the daughter of an incredibly talented actress named Natalie Moore and an incredibly great golfer named Keith Moore. Natalie West is her mom. Keith Moore is her dad. Zita is the critic. Zita, before you read your review, how did you discover this movie?
I have been incredibly interested in the community of Hasidic Jews for a very long time, ever since I read the book My Name is Asher Lev by Chaim Potok.
Oh, sure.
And my parents have taken a keen interest to my interest, and my dad pointed out the review to me in the Tribune. And I immediately said, oh, yes, I'm going to see this, without a doubt. So I saw it the next day.
To coin a phrase, you were really blown away, weren't you? I mean, you wrote me immediately and said, Rick, I've just seen an amazing movie. You were blown away, but you nevertheless, I'm looking at your review here, and it's wonderful. Are you ready to read it and enlighten the listeners of After Hours?
Oh, I would love to.
That's what you do. That's what you do here, Zita Moore. Take it away.
A man has lost his wife to a long sickness. Though their marriage lacked love, when it came to their son, they both gave their hearts. Under Hasidic law, which dictates the life of the man in question, he must refrain from raising his son until he finds love once again. Unfortunately, he already has in the form of his job as a father, and at the risk of breaking his own heart, he fights for his son. Menashe, directed by Joshua Z. Weinstein, tells the story of an imperfect father with the crinkled eyes and sardonic smile of a parent, extolling in their child's flaws. Indeed, Menashe, played in a marvelous debut by Menashe Lustig, has many shortcomings. He doesn't wear the black hat and satin coat expected of him. He's always late to prayer and for work, and sometimes he can't do his son, or even the honor of giving him a nutritious breakfast before school. But Reuven, played by Ruben Naborski, sticks around for the adventure. Tempering the muted chaos of his father's life, his bubbling effervescence keeps his foundation from breaking. His uncle, Itzhak, played with fierce dedication by Yoel Weishaus, thwarts Menashe's attempts to give his son a home by providing one of his own, blissfully free of mounting catastrophe. Neither gentleman fits into the category of model parent. Nevertheless, both performances radiate with a heart-rending earnestness to provide for Reuven what he cannot yet provide for himself. Inspired by true events in Lustig's life and peopled by largely first-time actors, the film owes its poignant wonder to writers Joshua Z. Weinstein, Highland Park, Illinois native Alex Lipschultz, and Musa Saeed. One must commit the name Shulam Dean to memory, author of the astonishing memoir All Who Go Do Not Return, an account of his life as a Skiver Hasid in New York. Dean acted as the film's story consultant, and it shows. The guiding hand of an individual with a depth and unsentimental knowledge of Menashe's predicament down to its roots and the sheltered world of New Square pulse through the film like a tender heartbeat. This jewel serves as an integral addition to the wealth of literature and cinema devoted to one rendering, a world few have glimpsed. One can hope Menashe encourages viewers to learn more and, more importantly, to love, even as you hear the sound of your own heart breaking.
That's a good review, Zita Moore. Michael Phillips in the Chicago Tribune gave it a rave. I don't know. I'm looking to see how many stars he gave it. Does this film, I'm assuming, Zita, this film is not in terribly wide distribution?
Not at the moment. It seems to be in the select theaters in the Chicagoland area, one of them being the Music Box, I believe. So definitely go to your local Music Box. And also, there's a detail that I neglected to mention. It is in Yiddish with English subtitles.
With subtitles. How is it doing? It seems to me that a film like this would have, even in the face of your rave review and Michael's, a hard time finding an audience. Do you think? Now I'm asking you to be more than a critic. I'm asking you to be a kind of social commentator. Do you think a film like this will have a hard time finding its audience? It may be winning some awards, I would think, but what do you think?
I ardently believe that it is garnering an audience very much keen on learning from its story and has an audience definitely rooted in Highland Park, where one of the producers is from.
Yeah.
Writers, Alex Lipschultz. So there's definitely a connection there. And when I went to see it in Renaissance in Highland Park, there was a fairly large crowd for a Sunday matinee there. So it is definitely garnering attention, which it is most definitely due. And I would say that as more word gets out about the lovely and heartwarming and heartrending story it tells, more people will pluck up see it, and I encourage them to in the wake of recent events.
Yeah, no kidding.
Definitely.
What's on your radar for the next review? When are you ever going to go to a play again? I love your movie reviews. I mean, this is one I didn't read. I had neglected, I guess, or missed Michael Phillips' review of it, and his was a rave, too. But I'm now this is on my I have to see this movie list. You want to stick to movies for a while? Don't you go to the theater anymore, Zita? Or just
we'll
go see your mom.
Yes, indeed. I will definitely be going to the theater shortly because my mom, Natalie West, as you so kindly mentioned, is going to be in two productions at a Red Orchid Theater, Evening at the Talk House and Traitor.
Mm-hmm.
Both written by Wallace Shawn and Brett Neveu, respectively. So I will be reviewing both of those plays in succession.
All right, honey. Well, maybe I'll go with you. I haven't seen you in such a long time, and I'm just it's great to talk to you on the phone. And I don't – have you ever reviewed one of your mom's shows in the old days of the Sunday papers? Do you remember? I don't know if you have.
I remember. I remember those days, and they will begin again.
Okay, honey.
The upcoming Red Orchid shows.
Well, yeah, Red Orchid is one of the great theater companies in this town. It's famous because Michael Shannon is a ensemble member, but they do astonishing work in one of the great intimate theater spaces of all time on Wells Street. All right, Zita, let's make a date. You and I will go see your mom in the show, and we'll drag your dad if he can get off the golf course, okay?
Sounds great.
All right, honey. Thank you very much for this review, too, as always. And thank you all for listening. Brett, thanks for engineering. Lise Graham, world's greatest producer. She should be in Hollywood soon. Lise FM is her podcast. She interviews all these cool people, including Tim Baltz, who's an old colleague of mine. I shared a stage with him some time ago. We'll be on next, if we survive the eclipse, we'll be on next Sunday. So think about tuning in, and thank you for listening.